We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus, our morning show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls this morning. We're happy to have back here on the program once again, Mike Ward. He's an avian ecologist with the Illinois Natural History Survey. He's also a visiting assistant professor in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences at the University of Illinois. And every once in a while, he's here on the program. At least we've tried to have him here on the show in the fall and in the spring, to talk a little bit about birds. And it's always fun to have him here. It's an opportunity for people to call in and ask whatever bird questions they have about birds and birding. If they have questions, say, about places in Illinois that are good places to go to see birds, he can help you out with that. Maybe there is a particular bird that you're curious about and you're not sure what it is. Give us the very best description that you can, as this is a challenge for him, but give us the best description. He'll see if he can come up with the answer for you. We'll maybe talk a little bit about some of the research that he's been involved in. And, you know, so generally we're open to whatever questions and you have, and I know he'll do his best to give you an answer. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have the toll-free line, so if it would be long-distance call, use that number, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Thanks very much for being here.
Well, thanks for having me. Yeah.
So we thought it'd be a good time to be talking now because it is, we're now getting into migration. So this will be an opportunity for people to see birds that are passing through that they would not ordinarily see, or at least they're not going to be hanging around here through the summer.
Oh, yeah. This is a great time. So migration's up and going right now. There's a lot of species that are moving through Illinois right now, heading toward Canada up to the Arctic this is our time to see them. And it's starting to get warm. A lot of birds that are breeding in your backyard are just showing up. Brown thrashers and chipping sparrows just showed up in the last week. So, and with the weather being so nice right now, it's really the time to get out there and enjoy the climate and see what birds are showing up. We're over the waterfowl. It's a peak for waterfowl migration right now. Clinton Lake and a lot of the ponds around East Central Illinois are full of all kinds of ducks that will be around for another couple of weeks, but then are heading up to the potholes of Canada or other places.
So. Yeah. How big a body of water do you really have to attract waterfowl like that?
Not too big. Especially, we don't have a lot of our wetlands in this part of the state are gone for certain different reasons. And so a little puddle can serve as a great habitat for shorebirds, blue-winged teal, green-winged teal. Just this morning, there's a couple little puddles in the South Farms, and there was blue-winged teal and snipe and killdeer and those. And so just little bitty puddles. In fact, little puddles that don't have fish sometimes have very good insect communities, and so there's a lot of productivity there, and so it can be really good for a lot of birds. So, even your back puddle in your backyard after it rains can hold a bird for a couple of days. So,
mm-hmm, okay. You were just recently telling me that you were in Panama.
Yeah, we were down in Panama working with Jeff Braun, who has a long-term project in Panama looking at life history traits of birds. And it actually stretches back 25, 28 years through different professors here at the U of I. And I was down there helping them out with some of their research. But what was really interesting to me is that you're down there and you're seeing the birds going through Panama. They'll be up here in a couple of weeks. And in fact, when I flew out of Panama, we were at the airport and you saw big kettles, so big migratory flocks of broadwing hawks and turkey vultures. We flew back to O'Hare. I get off the plane in O'Hare and we saw flocks of turkey vultures moving through O'Hare. So it's amazing the scale at which migration occurs. And, all these birds are starting to head this way. So it's really fun for me to see chestnut-sided warblers and Canada warblers and red vireos, knowing that in a little over a month, there are going to be, some of that population was moving through Illinois.
We have a caller, and we'll start in with someone in Ottawa, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. I happen to be walking on the Illinois-Michigan Canal near Buffalo Rock State Park, and I saw a pileated woodpecker, which I looked up in a bird book of Illinois. And I wonder how rare they are. And because I've never seen one before in my life, and I couldn't believe I saw this woodpecker that seemed like 18 inches long.
Right, yeah.
And I have another question about another species after you answer that one.
Sure. So pileateds are becoming more common. you know, 20, 30 years ago, there were pretty rare species in Illinois and pretty much confined to the southern portions of Illinois and to central Illinois. But lately, they've been kind of moving north and becoming more common up in the northern part of Illinois. Also, they're getting more used to people and more used to southern smaller woodlots. And so though historically they'd be in big tracts of forest, now you can find them in smaller woodlots. And I think it's just one of these birds that's getting used to humans. And it's still a pretty uncommon bird in northern Illinois, so you're pretty lucky. But in southern Illinois particularly, they're becoming pretty common.
And I've seen the white pelicans migrating through, and it's interesting. If you can get between them and the sun, where the sun's at your back and they're at your opposite point, when they circle on the thermals, they don't change color, of course, but they seem to. The white feathers show, and then the black ones, and it's quite spectacular. And I was wondering about their migration routes and where they go in the summer and winter, because I know they only come through here in the around fall and spring.
Yep. So yeah, pelicans are really interesting. So I grew up in western Illinois along the Illinois River Valley, and when I was young, pelicans were a really rare species, and now they've kind of changed their migratory route, so they go through. They go through Illinois in big numbers. In fact, we saw a couple hundred at Clinton Lake just a couple days ago. And there's a big population that breeds at Horicon Marsh in northern Wisconsin. But probably most of these birds are following up the Mississippi and going to North Dakota to breed. Actually, the populations in North Dakota really got knocked down by West Nile virus. And so I would have kind of expected to see fewer birds, but we're still seeing thousands come through Illinois. And, you know, this is the time of year they're all kind of grouping together. They have this interesting behavior where they go together in ponds and herd the fish into a certain shallows and eat them all up. And right now they're in great breeding plumage, too, so that's why you're seeing all the reflectivity off the white colors.
And I have one more question, and I'll let you go. We have a lot of bald eagles that come here to the Lock and Dam area by Starved Rock State Park on the Illinois River. And they seem to they're here in the dozens and dozens in the winter, but then in the summer – They seem to disappear. Where the heck do they go?
Yeah, so they're going north, most of them are. I mean, we still have 250-some pairs breeding in Illinois.
Oh.
But in the winter, these locks concentrate the food resources. So there's open water there. A lot of the fish are congregated there. And so there's not density-dependent competition. So there's a lot of food for everybody. But during the summer, all the fish kind of spread out, and so the eagles have to compete. And so they're not very happy having to compete with a buddy. And so they start getting these fights. And so they distribute themselves back out. So they're pretty well distributed along the river. There's probably one nesting somewhere or other not very far from the locks. But as the kind of the higher quality birds kind of get the best territories, the other ones kind of move to different areas. So they kind of distribute themselves across the landscape.
Oh, thank you so much.
No problem.
All right. Thanks for the call. In this hour of Focus, our guest is Mike Ward. He is an avian ecologist with the Illinois Natural History Survey. He's also a visiting assistant professor in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences. And we're talking about birds. And yeah, bird questions, he'll do his best to give you an answer. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455, and you can also send your question along by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. And here's somebody else to talk with in Mattoon. Line one, hello.
Yeah, hi. Great show. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I had a question about birds. This might be a little bit off the topic, but my question really had to do with pheasants. And I'm going back, 30 years, maybe 40 years, it just seemed to be an awful lot more pheasants. I can remember I lived in the Chicago area, and of course now the southern suburbs are so developed, so overpopulated, but we could go just a short time out of the city and hunt, and there are all kinds of birds, and now I live further downstate, and I don't see that many pheasants or hear about that much hunting of the pheasants except in controlled environments, and I'm just wondering... Number one, is the population taking a hit? Or number two, does it have to do with the farming technique where there's so much less coverage? And I'll just go ahead and listen offline. Thanks.
Sure. That's a great question. And, yeah, pheasants are really doing poorly. So over the last 25, 30 years, the populations have really declined. Initially, people were thinking, well, it's more coyotes or the winters were more severe. But the most likely explanation is farming practices, and that, you know, historically people had different covers out there. They had small grains, alfalfa, hay fields, and so there was more grassland out there. In the mid-1980s was really the bottom for all these grassland birds. Since then, CRP, Conservation Reserve Programs, kicked in. There's a little more grassland out there, but there's grassland here, grassland there, and the other issue is there's not connectivity. So it used to be people had kind of messy areas along roadsides and other places in their backyard where these pheasants would go through. And what it's looking like is happening is that, you know, there might be some concentrated areas, but when they start moving between different areas, they get picked off by red-tailed hawks or coyotes. So it's really the need to get, I mean, farming practices are cleaner. There's less kind of buffer strips, big grassy areas, hay fields, alfalfa fields, and that's really what's needed. And if you look at where there are good concentrations of pheasants still, kind of over in toward Peoria area and somewhat up in Gibson City, you do see there's more grassland on the landscape. And so and there's people have recognized that the pheasants are declining, and the Department of Natural Resources has a couple different programs out there to try to get landowners some resources to get more grassland on the landscape and to try to get more people actually pheasant hunting. Right now, there is still quite a bit of pheasant hunting in Illinois, but you know, these poor pheasant hunters have to work a lot to get these pheasants unless they actually, release them and let them shoot them. So, people understand there's a decline and there's a lot of effort to try to get more grasses out there.
This is something that I'm sure we've talked about before, and that is that for a particular species, loss of habitat is really significant. And, if you live in an urban environment, you may say, well, I see a lot of birds, but you see sparrows and starlings and grackles and robins and some cardinals and maybe a blue jay here and there and maybe a few other interesting things. But you might say, well, I see lots of birds. I see birds all the time. But those are the ones that are most comfortable living around people.
Yeah, exactly. So we're working on we talked about this in previous shows, but the 100-year bird survey where we're repeating these surveys that were done 50 years ago and then back in 1906, 1908. And if you look at the total number of birds out in Illinois, there might actually be more individual birds there today because there's so many grackles and starlings and cowbirds and stuff like that, whereas historically you would maybe have the same total number of birds but a lot more diversity. And so that's what a lot of birds that are good around humans have really increased. And so that is a great point, and that I think sometimes we get complacent in that we see birds flying around, so we don't really worry about conservation issues. But those represent maybe three or four species, and historically we would have had 15 or 20 species.
Yeah. Other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. And we have some other folks here. We'll go next to someone in Charleston, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
When we're driving around the countryside, we enjoy it when we see vultures soaring. And so the question is, how do vultures find their meal? Are they seeing it from the air, or are they smelling it? And do turkey vultures and black vultures, is it the same for both of those birds for finding their food? I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
Okay. So turkey vultures typically smell where their food's at. And so I forget what the compound is, but rotting flesh releases a certain compound, and turkey vultures have particular sensors that can pick up the smell, and that's how they find it. And a thing that's very interesting to me is that a few years ago, people were building pipelines across the continent, and they'd try to find the leaks in the pipeline. They'd pump this chemical through the pipes, and then they'd look for circling turkey vultures above certain areas in order to identify the holes in the pipeline. So, which is I thought was very clever on some engineer's part to actually know enough about birds to understand that might work. So, but turkey vultures are primary using smell. You notice turkey vultures, they have their wings are as a V, that we call it a dihedral, and they're riding on thermals. So they just get up on these thermals. It really costs them little energy because they're just riding the heat that's coming off the earth. And so they just keep on circling and circling, smelling for these rotting animals. Black vultures, on the other hand, have their morphology is such that they don't soar quite as much. So they're probably doing more sight. The other thing that turkey vultures do, which is a lot of birds do this, is they have pretty complex social behaviors, and then they keep tabs on their buddies. So if their buddy's sneaking off to go to a certain direction, there might be a big dead cow over there, and they'll follow them. And so these birds roost together communally. They all go back to the same spot every night and sleep in the same spot. And in the morning, the birds that tend to know where the food is go off first, and then if somebody doesn't know where to go, they just follow their buddies. And so they have these pretty complex social structures to kind of find the dead stuff that's out there. Historically, it was probably the dead stuff was pretty pretty patchily distributed across the landscape, you know, a big dead bison here or there. But now that we have so much dead stuff along roads, turkey vulture populations have really increased, and they're doing really well.
Well, that's what – and I have certainly – I guess there are actually places in urban areas where they have a lot of them, and I have read things suggesting that that's just – you wouldn't be – you shouldn't be surprised if now in urban areas where you had not seen these birds before. And believe me, if you've seen one, you'd know it because they're really big. Yeah. We should not be surprised if we actually start to see more of these.
Oh, yeah. There's no question. They're moving into in towns. You know, I live out in St. Joe. They're moving into St. Joe. There's two reasons why this is probably. One is they're reliant on thermals. So as the landscape heats up in the morning, they usually don't get out of bed till later. However, in towns with parking lots and other areas, thermals are, develop earlier in the morning, so they can actually feed longer in urban areas because they can take advantage of these thermals. Also, if you go down to the tropics, like we were down in Panama, black vultures and turkey vultures are all over town eating kind of refuse, kind of like what crows eat around here, French fries and stuff. And so historically, these birds were probably persecuted. People probably thought they were hawks and shot at them. We don't see that too much in Illinois anymore. People still shoot at hawks, but not nearly at the level they used to. And so they're starting to learn that, you know, urban areas are easy place to take advantage of. And so they're starting to move in these areas. The one problem with turkey vultures are if they do nest in your backyard or somewhere nearby, they are pretty messy. You know, if they get startled, their first response is to regurgitate everything. And so obviously they're eating dead stuff, and when you're regurgitated dead stuff isn't exactly the most pleasant stuff to be around. So so people don't like them being around, but I don't think they're going to be here to stay, I think.
All right. Again, questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. I just recently in my yard have noticed a lot of grackles, and I know that they're birds that are around. It's not like I was surprised to see them, but and maybe it's just that they seem suddenly to appear, and in a pretty good numbers, and you know, maybe it's just that I haven't seen them in a while.
Yeah, there's two things going on with grackles. One is big flocks of blackbirds arrive in the last couple weeks, and so they can concentrate in people's backyards if they have more food. Also, grackles are kind of unique of the birds around in central Illinois, and they breed really early for a passerine, for a perching bird, and they're already breeding out there. And so you can get and if they tend to be not very territorial in that. There can be many nests in your backyard. And so it can be happenstance in that in your backyard you have many evergreens or other trees they like, and you can get quite a few nests. And you don't really – it's still kind of puzzling to me why they do this. But they start breeding in March, and they don't breed the rest of the summer. They have one brood. They produce their offspring, and they're done, whereas most other birds haven't really thought about breeding yet. Although mourning doves are starting to get geared up for breeding, and sort of cardinals. But most other birds aren't even thinking about breeding for another couple of weeks. So
yeah. It seems like there's a lot of nest-building activity or doing what they seem to be out there and rummaging around. And I don't know if they're looking for stuff to eat or they're looking for stuff to make nests with.
Well, they could be feeding their young right now. So they probably have – most grackles probably have young right now. So they're trying to get you know, grubs and stuff to feed their young. And a lot of their young, as opposed – most birds – in the nest in Illinois, most nestlings don't starve. Starvation's pretty uncommon. But for grackles, it's pretty common. They breed so early, there's not a lot of food. It gets cold. And so a lot of their young starve. So they, you know, they have a lot of pressure on them to find as much food as they can to keep their young alive. So.
And I know before we've talked a little bit about global warming and about birds, and I guess the reason I was thinking about it again is that just recently there has been a report issued on State of the Birds 2010, and it was something that I think the government was involved in and a lot of people who do research on birds were involved in. Is there anything that's really new in that subject of, you know, birds and global climate?
Yeah. There's a lot of interest in it. There's a lot of people studying different questions. I mean, the way I look at it in Illinois is, you know, we're worried that the average temperature might get a degree or two warmer, but what we're really concerned about is the extremes. So the extreme cold, the extreme warm, that's what's going to influence a lot of the populations that we're worried about in Illinois. We're trying to come up with some ideas about, you know, it seems to be wetter in the spring, and there might be subtle things that happen. So the wet springs actually might keep the farmers out of the field a couple more weeks, which then may in turn allow killdeer and other birds that breed in farm fields to actually get off more young. And so it's likely that it's going to be difficult to anticipate how climate change is going to impact the birds in Illinois. And it's probably going to be big impacts, but they're going to be impacts that we're not going to really identify until they kind of happen, because they're going to be very – a lot of factors involved in these things. One thing we're worried about with these extremes – and the averages is, you know, in Illinois, obviously a cardinal in your backyard has to endure temperatures of negative whatever and up to 100 degrees. In Panama, a lot of these birds have evolved to have very little variation in how warm it is, especially lowland tropical forests. And there's some indication that global warming might maybe not change how warm or how cold it is, but change the extremes. And these extremes could have really big impacts on birds that have evolved to live between, 70 and 80 degrees Fahrenheit. If you start pushing down to 65, it wouldn't make a difference around here for any of our birds. That'd be fine. But if that happened in the tropics for a prolonged period of time, there could be extreme consequences.
Let's take another caller. Someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. I didn't hear the beginning of your show. My question is about mallard ducks. Is that appropriate?
Sure. Yeah.
We live not too many blocks from Bulwark Trail, and there's some kind of a drainage ditch there, and then there's a lake just past that at Mattis Park. And we have a one-acre fenced-in backyard. A pair of mallard ducks has come to our yard, and they come for long periods of time, several times a day. And our granddaughter loved it. We thought it was great. We put out some cracked corn for them. Well, this morning, our 5-pound dog discovered some things in our yard he didn't like. And I can see that that's going to be a problem. And I wondered, once they nest, will they quit coming to our yard because we don't have a pond or any kind of water? Yeah. Is that unusual for them to do something like this?
Not really. The mallards are really interesting species. And obviously, they're waterfowl, and they need to get their young to water. But a lot of times, the most limiting resource for them is a safe place to have a nest. There's a lot of predators that eat nests on the ground, like how mallards nest. And, if you're a coyote and you come across a nest with 12 eggs, that's a great day for you. And so they're looking for these safe areas. And actually, it's pretty interesting in that we've done research up in Chicago trying to protect certain terns, it's a type of kind of like a gull. And so they get eaten a lot by coyotes. So we put up these fences to keep all the coyotes out for the terns. But as soon as we put the fences out, the mallards somehow know this is a safe spot. And they come flocking in there, and we'll have two or three nests in a very small area. And it turns out what's probably going on is that birds, unlike us, can see into the UV. So they see more of the spectrum. And it turns out that a lot of mammal urine fluoresces in the UV. And so when they look at the ground, we see grass. They actually might see grass plus, coyote urine. And so because they can see where predators are, as they move across the landscape, they might be able to determine, there's a bunch of coyotes and foxes and mink here. But for some reason in this person's backyard, there might be a dog, but there's only a couple spots with urine. So it's probably a safer spot than here. And there's actually research going on out in the prey potholes to try to quantify this, to determine, how much, mammal urine can these birds see, and then how are they able to take advantage of knowing where these predators are and then nesting in safe areas. And so you do see mallards nesting in really strange areas. And I think the reason for this is that they're using these cues they've evolved with to find safe spots. And the safe spot happens to be in your flower bed, in your backyard, or some really areas that we wouldn't consider wetlands, but they consider safe areas. And they're close enough to a drainage ditch that they can get their young to the drainage ditch, to the pond, and into safety once they get to the pond.
So they might very well build a nest in our yard.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. We thought it had to be right by the water.
No. They can be pretty farther in the water than you anticipate. It's not like wood ducks can be really far from the water, blocks and blocks. But mallards are usually within, a block or two from the water. But they often don't nest right next to the water just because there's so many predators that tend to walk along the edge of the streams and lakes.
Well, we're probably at least 8 blocks or 10 from the stream. Last year, one morning, we found 10 ducklings in our front yard, and we live on Kirby, which is a busy street in Champaign. And so we were chasing around with nets and gathering up these ducklings, and when I called the wildlife place over at the U of I, the girl that answers the phone there had picked up a mother mallard that had been injured right in front of our house on her way to work, just happened. And one of the babies had been killed out in the street, and so we were able to take him over there. And so she may very well have been nesting in the neighborhood then.
Oh, yeah, it probably was, yeah.
And she was headed the wrong way to get to water. Okay, well, thank you very much.
No problem.
I'm really enjoying your show.
All right, thanks for the call. What is it about mallards that seems to be, if you have some body of water in an urban area,
little pond in a park or something like that, if you see a duck, that's what it's going to be.
Yeah,
pretty
well,
much.
Pretty almost always. I mean, wood ducks are also. I think historically, the mallards probably were more flexible on what habitats they used, whereas the other ducks, like blue-winged teal, green-winged teal, shovelers and stuff, while they may have historically bred here, they really nested in prairie potholes, so really shallow emergent wetlands. Mm-hmm. And we really don't have those anymore. And so their range is really contracted until, you know, most of those birds, blue-winged teal do breed in Illinois, but a lot of the other birds are really rare breeders, and you have to go to northern Wisconsin, the prairie potholes. And so we've lost all that habitat, so there's really not the impetus to breed around here. And so if you do see breeding ducks around here, it's almost always either going to be a mallard or a wood duck, pretty much. I mean, there is some other species like blue-winged teal and hooded mergansers, but, you know, if you're in town, you see it's mainly a mallard.
Yeah. All right. Our guest in this part of Focus is Mike Ward. He is an avian ecologist with the Illinois Natural History Survey, also visiting assistant professor in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences, and is here to talk about birds. And if you have questions, he'll see if he can give you an answer. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Next caller is in Champaign and line two. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I'm going back to the mallards for a second. Mm-hmm. I looked in my backyard a couple years ago, and there were a couple of mallards high on the branch of a black walnut tree. And, whoa, that's something to see in your backyard. We have a lot of bird feeders back there. I don't know what attracted them, but I wasn't sure I wanted them back there because I've been down that bulwark trail walking and on my bike, and it's sort of messy around some places. So I opened the door or let the dog out, and once they saw the dog, they never came back. But my question with the urine information is, what is it that they see? Do they see the dead vegetation, or do they smell? I'm not clear what they could be spotting with their eyes.
Yeah, so what they're spotting with their eyes is, so they, as opposed to us who see, you know, Roy G. Biv, the colors of the rainbow, they see beyond that into the ultraviolet, and so they can see, you know, obviously we can't visualize this because they're seeing something we can't see, but it turns out that a lot of secondary compounds in urine are pretty volatile. And so as they break down in the environment, they probably they're visible in this ultraviolet spectrum. And so it's literally that they look at something and see something different than we do. Interestingly, on the same topic, this was first identified with raptors like kestrels and rough-legged hawks, because no one could figure out why they'd concentrate in one field and not the other field. Well, they're using vole urine. And it turns out voles have actually evolved defenses where voles use latrines. They go in to hide in certain areas and urinate. And you know, the question is, why would a vole be, you know, worried about where it urinates? And so then all started making sense that these voles are being preyed on by these raptors, and the raptors are finding this large concentration of voles by urine, and so they're trying to hide their urine. And so, it's actually the bird to see stuff differently than we do. And it probably is true that this urine breaks down very quickly, and it's probably true that different types of mammals have – their urine is fluorescent at different levels. So it depends on what they eat. So for dogs that eat dog food, I don't know if you need research of this, but it seems unlikely there's a lot of fluorescence associated with that. Whereas we know that for like some of the weasels and raccoons, that they're eating certain compounds, plant compounds that probably are, when they do metabolize to their system, are fluorescent.
So do you think it's a color they're seeing or just shininess, or can we imagine what they're seeing?
Well, right now I'm teaching ornithology, and I try to come up with something for the students. It's always tricky because it's probably that they're actually seeing a different color. So something just beyond, you know, what we can kind of envision for our colors. So it's probably not something shiny, but it's probably something that sticks out someone because it's important information. It also turns out that a lot of birds, their plumage, when they're really shiny, birds are seeing what we see plus extra. So there's always this big question about, like, for blue grosbeaks. We did all this research, and all these blue grosbeaks look the same to us. And what one female will say, well, that one's a stud, and this one's a wimp. And we can never figure out why. What turns out that stud has a lot of UV characteristics. And so when the female sees that bird, it looks like a stud. But for us, they look the same. And so it's just – they just see more colors essentially than we do.
Can I ask one more question?
Yeah, sure.
I looked in the backyard the other day, and I thought it was a robin, but it wasn't. It was orange on the bottom, black on the top with some white streaks through it. and a black beak.
It's a tough one. White streaks through the back?
Well, not streaks, but white spots. That,
I would guess a eastern towhee. These are called rufous-sided towhee. They're going to be on the ground. They have a dark head. They have some white underneath, but come rufous on the sides, and then their back has some white speckling on it. And they would be in the same type of habitat, a little smaller than robin, but almost the same size.
Right.
And they have the same behavior, so.
So they feed off the ground.
Exactly, yep.
Okay. Thank you so much.
All right, thanks for the call. Well, I have somebody who sent an email here. Let me read this to you. He writes that he and his daughter have been developing an interest in bird watching together. She's 4. But has been into birds since she first became aware of birds. She noticed something, he says, I've never seen and would like to build a better explanation for her. We have a red-tailed hawk that gives us a flyover a few times a day. But the other day, he says that they saw an entire flock of them. He said, I took a quick count and tallied up about 16. And he says, I'd never seen that many hawks swirling around, so I wanted to make sure. And sure enough, that's what they were. And his daughter fed off his curiosity, asked if they might be breeding. But he says, I really didn't have a good answer. I know it's difficult, but could you suggest a few theories to explain why so many hawks would be gathering together?
Yeah, so it is a bit interesting. Red-tailed hawks do breed right now, so they're on eggs. But that actually would suggest they shouldn't be big flocks. But hawks do, when they migrate, kind of like we're talking about turkey vultures, they use thermals. And so Broadwing hawks, and it's not very common in red-tails, but you can see concentrated red-tails. As they're migrating, they're all kind of migrating together on these thermals. If it was a few weeks from now, I would say that it was probably broadwing hawks, because you in Champaign-Urbana, you can see what we call kettles or broadwing hawks moving through. But if there are red-tails, it's probably birds that are migrating, probably young birds. Generally speaking, young birds migrate after adults. And in some species, young birds don't breed their first year. And so, and young birds are naive, just like humans. And young humans are naive, and that they have to learn how to migrate, how to get to where they're going. And so a lot of times you'll see constraints of young birds moving all together and kind of using each other to help them find food and to get to where they're going. So I would suggest it was probably a migratory flock moving in some direction. So.
All right. Hope that helps. Other questions, welcome. Give us a call or send us an email. We have some others ready to go. And next we'll talk with someone in Champaign. Line 1. Hello.
Yes. Hi. Mm-hmm. I just read the other day an interesting article about the whooping cranes. And in this article, it said there were only 256 whooping cranes. And they were talking about the whole population, as far as I know, both the western and the eastern population. So I was wondering, is that correct? Because I thought there were a few more than that. The other thing it said was that there's been an increase in the death of whooping cranes over the last several decades, and they're doing some GPS tracking of some of them to try to determine that. And I was just wondering if you knew anything more about what some of the theories are behind why there's an increase in the deaths of the birds and what's going on with that population.
Sure. So I think that's probably right. There's only a couple hundred whooping cranes left. They get a lot of attention, and they're big, and when you go in certain areas, you can see them. But, you know, they were down to and somewhere around 80 at some point in time, and they've built back up to, you know, the mid-200s, near 300. But we do have GPS transmitters on a bunch of them. People are doing a lot of research. The eastern race, the kind of or eastern population that breeds in Wisconsin, migrates through Chicago, Champaign area, and goes down to Florida. That took a real hit last year, where a hurricane in winter killed quite a few. We know that there's just, you know, you have so few, when you lose a couple, people get really worried. And over the last few years, people mistakenly shoot them thinking they're snow geese. Young whooping cranes a lot of times do silly things and end up in a bad situation where they get caught up in fishing line or stuff. And so there has been, I think, a relative increase in the number that are dying. But I think that in a natural population, you wouldn't be worried about it. We're just very worried about it because there's only 200 and some left. And so every one of them is very crucial to sustain the population. And unfortunately, you know, they're breeding down in Texas – or wintering in Texas and wintering in Florida. And these are areas where hurricanes are pretty common. There's all kinds of other random events that the last couple of years have really caught up to them. And a lot of them have unfortunately died through these weather-related events.
Okay, so a lot of it has been in weather types of problems.
Yeah, I mean, people are still shooting them, unfortunately. In Texas, you'll hear about it every year. Some hunter, you know, it's flying over high. They'll think it's a snow geese or something like that. And to the credit of the federal government, a lot of times they figure out who shot them and really try to make an example for other hunters that, you know, they find them quite a bit and, you know, they need to be really careful around Aransas and some of the other refuges down there that we know are critical wintering grounds for whooping cranes.
Do you know what the historical population numbers were for whooping cranes?
Well, they were pretty common. I mean, we know they bred in Illinois in the early 1800s, and they were throughout the prairie potholes. So historically, there were probably, you know, tens of thousands or more. And so as the prairie potholes kind of were drained or other things happened, they retreated into this last population that occurs up in northern Canada. And we're trying to get two populations going, one in Wisconsin and one in New Mexico. But, you know, it's just you know, they're a long-lived bird. They don't reproduce a lot every year, so it's going to take quite a bit of time to really build up the populations.
Okay, and one last question. How old are they when they begin to reproduce?
They're a couple years old. I'm not sure off the top of my head, but I know I would imagine it takes them a couple years to reproduce, two or three.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. On to another caller, Atlanta, line four. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. We live in the country, and over our garage we have a motion light. And for the last 3 years, we've had phoebes nest there. And I was just wondering, are they the same phoebes or are they, you know, offspring? Or?
Yep. So phoebes are actually the bird that was first studied in North America to understand site fidelity, the tendency for a bird to come back to the breed in the same spot. Mm-hmm. And that was a guy named James John Audubon, who is why we call Audubon Societies, Audubon Societies. Mm-hmm. He put a silver piece of thread on a bird's leg, and it came back to nest in his back, you know, outhouse the next year. And it's very likely that it's the same phoebe in your backyard. So they're probably wintering down in the Gulf Coast states, coming back up in the exact same spot. Also interesting about phoebes, so most birds have really low what we call natal phylopatry. That is the tendency for the birds born in your backyard to come back to your backyard in future years. However, phoebes are completely different in that they have pretty high natal phylopatry. So it's possible, even if the adults might have died, you know, phoebes probably only live 4, 5, 6 years, if they would have died, it could be their young coming back to breed in your backyard.
That's interesting. That and there's a little bit of an overhang, so it's pretty, you know, they're pretty protected.
Yeah. The tendency is if a bird finds a good spot to breed and it produces young there, if it lives, it's going to try to get back there because it knows it's a safe spot.
They usually have two broods.
Yep. Phoebes, if it's a good spot, they'll knock out two broods to have, you know, 6, 7 young. And then a lot of those young probably die during migration. We know that. For a lot of birds, that's true. But probably a couple of them live, and they're probably back somewhere in your general neighborhood.
That's interesting. We enjoy them. They're really, really cute birds. Well, thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
Bye.
On average, what's the lifespan of a bird, or is it really dependent upon really different from species to next?
It's different between species, but actually it's a really tricky thing to get at because as opposed to looking at animals that don't move very far, if we try to understand what the survival rate of phoebes are, you don't know whether it died on its way down to Alabama or it just was in Alabama and decided, I'm not going back to Rantoul this year. I'm going somewhere else. So it's really hard to tease that apart. And because of that, we tend to have estimates that are probably too low. So generally, we think birds live 2, 3, 4 years. It probably is the first year a lot of them die. And so there's mortality is probably really high that first year. But if they make it through the first year, they're on average, birds are probably living 4, 5, 6, 7 years. But now we know there's longevity records because we do bird banding. Mm-hmm. And so they have 13-year-old chickadees and 16-year-old warblers and stuff. But we do know, like, parrots, eagles and stuff can live 30, 40 years. So yeah. There's a lot of variation. And it probably they live a little longer than we had thought maybe 10 years ago.
Yeah. All right. We have another caller here. Let's see. This is someone who is on our line number 2, and they are in Champaign.
Hi.
Hello.
Uh-huh. I have a question. Has anybody brought up the whooping crane that seems to, nest in along the creek in southwest Champaign?
No. It would seem unlikely that a whooping crane's nesting in southwest Champaign. It seemed more likely that a great blue herons would be.
Yeah, or something like that with a big beak.
Yeah, that would be great blue herons. They're actually increasing, and they nest in rookeries. So they all nest together in a colonial areas. And there's a couple rookeries we know that are out there in Champaign County now. I think there's actually a couple nesting along the Salt Fork, a couple out towards St. Joe, a couple over toward Ourton. There's a big one out at Ourton. And so
there's one that has I thought it was one until I went down there and found out it was two. Our creek, the Copper Slough that parallels Duncan,
Yep.
And it goes down through Southwest Champaign. Well, you know, I always thought it was one, and I jogged down the creek and found out that it was two. They just look alike, you know?
Yeah, yep.
And there's a nest because of all the poop that's around it.
Oh, yeah. It could
so
be.
I was just amazed, you know, that it's in here in town. So is that normal? Or
they are getting more common in towns, great blue herons are. And it's really a testament to the Clean Water Act. We're cleaning up a lot of our waters. And because of these streams are cleaner, they have a lot more fish. And so they're taking advantage of these things. And they're getting – when I was younger, they were a pretty rare bird. And now there are quite a few around East Central Illinois.
So if you wanted to feed it to help it survive, what do you give it?
Well, I wouldn't – I think it would be fine on its own. Herons are a tricky thing. We should put a warning out right now that if they're injured or something, you go to them, they're one of the birds that goes for the eyes. So there's a researcher at Iowa State years ago that was trying to help one that got hit by a road, and it took out one of his eyes. So it's one of the birds that if it's injured, you're best off not messing with them because they are they look pretty passive. But you don't want to mess around with herons because
I just wanted to help it, you know.
Yeah, they'll be fine. I mean, if it's there, it knows it's there because there's a lot of food. I'm sure it'll be fine.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
All right. We have an email here from your cousin-in-law in Minneapolis.
Oh, yeah? Oh, great.
Yeah. And she writes, she has a 12-room Martin house, which she says parenthetically has been taken over by some type of wren, which she says is okay with her. But she goes on, when, if ever, should I clean out the old nesting material? She says it was so packed that they could barely get in. She said she did it for the first time this spring after about 5 years. So she says after cleaning it out, she was completely guilt-ridden. She cut some quarter-inch fleece strips and put some in each room so they had something to start with. And her husband, your cousin, says that he should take that out because it will cause problems.
Yeah.
What do you think?
You should feel bad. The the nests, so birds have lice and fleas and such. And so a lot of birds don't use the same nest year after year because they can't – if they get these ectoparasites, it can cause real problems. And for cavity nesters like martins and stuff, there are actually – like for cliff swallows, there's a certain type of ectoparasite that just feeds on that species alone. And so it's good for martin houses to clean them out every year to get rid of that because the all that debris in there will provide an area for these lice and the fleas and stuff to overwinter. And if they're there, sometimes the birds, that's the only place they can go. And so it doesn't really affect the adults, but the young get a lot of these parasites on them. And then the young, most of the time they'll leave the nest, so you think, oh, they're okay, but they'll be at low condition. And so when they start migrating, they probably won't make it through migration. So it's good to clean out these every year. In terms of putting flea strips or pesticides in them, I wouldn't worry about that. If you just clean them out every year, like house wren nests, bluebird boxes, pearl martins, all these will build up with some of these different ectoparasites. And so it's probably a good idea to every year clean them all out. You don't have to bleach them all out and stuff. Just clean out all the debris. And the cold winters, especially up in Minnesota, are going to knock out anything you got to worry about.
Well,
thanks.
Yeah. Well, I hope that gets to the question of the cousin-in-law. And we have about, 6-7 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Mike Ward. He is an avian ecologist with the Illinois Natural History Survey and also visiting assistant professor in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences. And if you have bird questions, give us a call, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And let's go to Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Hello and good morning to you all.
Hello.
I'd like to bring up a couple of topics. First, the one about the herons. North of Danville in Heron Park, which is a wetlands just north of Danville on Newell Road, West Newell Road, they have a very large rookery of blue heron that you can actually walk, and they have observation benches set back where you can watch them. Very interesting place. Very nice place to see all kinds of birds. The other point I wanted to talk to you about, and you may or may not know about this, and it also goes along with the purple martin. There's a community over in Iowa that has a purple martin festival or something, and they've been noticing that there's a serious demise in purple martin that seems to be associated with the buffalo gnat that we're beginning to get, which is a very nasty little pest to have. And if we find out more and more about it, you'll all be wondering why we have to have that animal around. But they seem to be really destroying the nest and stuff of purple martins and just literally sucking them dry.
Yeah. Yeah, I've dealt with buffalo gnats. They are not very fun creatures, for sure. Pearl Martin populations are declining, and we know buffalo gnats, there are now records in Illinois of them, feeding on nestlings in the nest and causing some to die. And it's one of these things where it's probably a combination of things. Pearl Martins have been declining for quite a few years, and it's probably that, you know, there's not as many bugs available, big moss across the landscape. And then you couple that with this buffalo gnats, which it's my understanding they were native to the area. I mean, there might be bigger concentrations of them now. Historically, you know, they might have killed some Pearl Martins here and there, but we probably wouldn't have worried about it because in the big scheme of things, it probably didn't make much difference. Now that we have the Pearl Martins declining, and you couple that on top of if buffalo gnats do cause a problem, and because Pearl Martins are colonial nesters, they're all nesting in the same spot, it tends to be they're more susceptible. So you start losing a couple big colonies in a town here and there, it can make a big difference. And so it is something to be worried about. I know there's some people studying some buffalo gnats at the survey and other places here on campus and trying to understand what their impact will be. But yeah, I would agree it's something that we should be a bit worried about. And Pearl Martins, again, are something that I'm worried about in that the population is declining, especially in their northern part of their range. And we really don't know why. We have some ideas about moths and maybe the farther they have to migrate, the more stress they have. But it's one of those questions we really need to get more information on and come up with a plan.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you. Maybe about 5 minutes left. Someone here on line one. We'll go there next. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
When do we clean out those bird houses?
Yeah, so for most birds, I would clean them out in early spring, you know, before the birds get back for a Pearl Martin. So I would say, you know, the first warm day in March, go out and clean those things all out and it'd be fine. You could do it in late fall as well. Some birds will roost in boxes over the winter. So sometimes chickadees will do that. Bluebirds will do it in some areas. You're okay. You just don't want to do it in, you know, April, May, June, July, August, sometime during the breeding season. Anytime other than that, you'll probably be okay.
Not between April and August, any other time.
Yep.
All right, thanks.
All right, very good. Again, I want to call in real quick. We get in a question or two left, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I don't know if this is how much you want to say about this. I did think it might be interesting just to talk about this recent information you hear that's just come out, just been published, that the only the second ever bird to have its genome sequenced has come out. This is the zebrafinch. So what's really interesting about this, and I think it also connects with some of the research that's been actually done here at the University of Illinois and the other kind of things that people are looking at, is this really interesting question of how much behavior might be actually tied to genetics and how much, in fact, behavior might be wired up for certain kinds of behaviors. Yeah.
No, it's amazing research done here on campus and Dale Clayton and his postdocs and others. The, you know, it just something that you notice, even bird watching, going out into the field and walking through Meadowbrook Park, you can notice the amazing behavior of birds. And a lot of their behaviors are much more complex than we give them credit for. Sequencing the zebrafinch genome, they're looking at how they learn their song, how these young males learn their song. And, you know, they have this special time when they can learn certain syllables, certain tracks, and other times when they kind of become crystallized and they don't learn anything from there. And it can be very important and it can be very dynamic. And certain birds we know can learn all kinds of different repertoires. Their repertoires are really important for females choosing them. They're really important in defending territories. And I think the take-home for me is that, that we have so much more to learn about birds. As we sequence these genomes and learn more about how complex these behaviors are, it only adds more to what the questions are out there. And from a conservation perspective, it just means, you know, we need to preserve as many of these individuals and species as possible in order to conserve the gamut of genetic variability that's across the landscape.
Yeah, I think some people think that it actually might have something to contribute to our understanding of how human beings learn language.
Yeah, which is amazing. I mean, that's, you know, people pick up on that, obviously, the humans do, and it's very interesting. And then I read about the stuttering part about how, you know, understanding how the zebrafinches learn their songs in a certain period of their life and how the genes go to there might give us some idea about how we learn, you know, language and might help us. And there's definitely all kinds of interesting things. There's dementia. I know there's some research on that where birds get old, but they don't seem to get they don't seem to have impaired senescence. They don't seem to lose how quick they are or their ability to be cognitive. And then they produce these proteins that help renew kind of connections in the brain. And so there's a lot of things that birds do. If we understood, it could really help a lot with our health system. And so, hopefully these kind of illustrate that sometimes people think, well, why are you spending all this resources on understanding zebrafinches? And the reality is they can go a long ways to helping humans. So.
Yeah. All right. Let's get at least one more caller. Matt Toon, line four. Hello.
Good morning.
Yeah.
I am a recently retired school teacher, and I'd love to learn more about birding. What is the best resource in the Champaign area to learn more about birds, to hear bird lectures, to join a group of bird watchers on walks?
Yeah.
And I'll listen offline. Thank you.
Okay. Sure. Yeah. For everybody, whether the four-year-old, like the email said, or whomever, I think the best thing to do is get in the field. The Champaign County Audubon Society, Beth Chado, Helen Parker, and others kind of run the Audubon Society. They have great lectures, I think, once a month. One of the great resources you have here is Greg Lambeth, who leads bird tours on Sunday mornings out of Busey Woods. And just, you know, it's amazing. I think he's just started those up again this year. You go there for a couple months, and it's going to be amazing. And as the more birds migrate in, you're going to get, you know, right now maybe 30 species. You build up to 50. And then before long, you know, he's probably going to be seeing 100 species in the morning out there. And just getting out in the field, you can. There's a lot of great online tools. You can get stuff for your iPod to learn stuff. But you can't replace field experience. Getting out there, hearing the birds, understanding their behavior, that's what it comes down to.
All right. Real quick, let's see if we can do Chrisman, line one. Hello.
Yes, I'm seeing quite a few bluebirds around my house. I don't have any houses out or anything. I would like to get some. I would like to hear him tell about how far to put them apart, where to put them, and stuff like that.
Okay.
I'll hang up
there. Sure. All right, we've got to be kind of quick.
Sure. So the biggest thing with bluebird houses is put them out in open areas, pretty far from each other, you know, probably at least 50, 60 feet from each other, but put them in the most open areas you have. They like open areas. Put them on a pole so snakes and raccoons can get up them, and just any kind of box should work. The big thing is put them out in the open. They like to be open, see stuff coming, and that's the key there.
All right. Well, there we got to finish up with the prompts, I'm sure, on another day. Mike will come back. Mike Ward is an avian ecologist with the Illinois Natural History Survey, also visiting assistant professor in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences. Hey, thanks very much.
All right. Thank you for having me.
All right. Programs here on WILO made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, whose Millercom Lecture Series presents Disgust and Death by Colin McGinn Friday, April 9th at 4 p.m. at the Knight Auditorium in the Spurlock Museum. Online, www.cis.illinois.edu.